Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 134 of season 11 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we curry our way through the 2001 HBO award-winning miniseries Band of Brothers, 5 minutes at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again to finish off his three-episode arc is John from the Armchair Commanders podcast. Welcome back once again to the show, John.
Thank you for having me.
We get deeper and deeper into the, I don't know if you want to call it the history of these men or the future, because, you know, for us it's the past, but for them it's their future. So it's a combination of both, but it's still done really well.
You know, it's just wrapping up the story, if you will.
Yeah.
Or rounding it out.
True. Like I said, I feel, you know, I said this yesterday, I feel a little gypped that we don't get some of the other stories, like about Joe Toy or Garnier. Or I'm trying to think of which of the other characters, Smokey, you know, we don't get anything about him. You know, we got last week, we were told about Shifty. Also, they don't tell us about Malarkey. You know, any of the characters who are not here in this place playing baseball, they just don't tell us anything about them. And like I said, I feel a little gypped about that. So we are going to slightly talk about them.
Yeah, if they had some sort of unfortunate end, you know, like Garnier and Toy, who lost their legs, it's like, that's where you leave off with their story is, you know, they lost their legs and they went home.
Exactly. But again, you know, it would be nice to hear about them also. And even someone like Babe, who is prominent, they also don't tell us about it. He's not shown as one of these people here. You know, so it's interesting. Episode 134 begins with Winters continuing his epilogue narration and ends with Winters thumbing it up. So he started talking yesterday about John Martin, and the way that it continues today is this is, and then start his own construction company. He splits his time between Arizona and a place in Montana. And again, that's all they tell us about John Martin. We do get to see that, you know, he definitely has a great arm, because the way that he throws the ball, just, you know, it's done really well, and it gets all the way to Luz, which is also a great way to, you know, to connect the two stories. But we'll get to Luz in a second. So Martin is described, his future is described on page 251, and it says, John Martin attended Ohio State University on his GI Bill money, then returned to his railroad job. He became a supervisor, had a car, secretary in pension building, and was making money on the side by building houses on speculation. In 1961, he gave it all up, and over the intense protests of his wife and children then in high school, moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and started building homes. He had $8,000 in total capital, and everyone thought he was crazy. At the end of the first year, he paid more in taxes than he had ever made working for the railroad. Soon he was building apartment complexes and nursing homes. He expanded his activities into Texas and Montana. In 1970, he bought a cattle ranch in the mountains of western Montana. Today, he's a multimillionaire. He still likes to take risks, although he no longer jumps out of airplanes. He has resisted tempting offers to sell his business. The president of Martin Construction today is John Martin, while his wife Patricia is the vice president and treasurer. They're also the directors and sole stockholder. So again, it's nice to know a little bit more than just the fact that, you know, he started a construction company and split his time between Arizona and Montana. You know, that's pretty much all they tell us. So, you know, it helps to have this
information. They keep it pretty simple for most of the guys.
Yes. You know, they want to try to give us, you know, layman descriptions of the men, you know, from that perspective. It's interesting the way that they do that. As I said, Luz catches the ball, and we get a little bit of information about Luz. It says, George Luz became a handyman in Providence, Rhode Island. As a testament to his character, 1,600 people attended his funeral in 1998. Again, that's all they say here. The funny thing is, the book doesn't tell us anything about Luz's future. He's not even mentioned here with when they're mentioning all the men's futures. Now, I know that part of it has to do with the fact of, you know, Ambrose went with the information he got from the men themselves. So if George Luz didn't send the information in, it wouldn't be there, you know, that type of thing. You know, I find it a little interesting that information is completely missing. But, you know, what can you do? Not much. Right. Not much can be done about that. The epilogue where they talk about, you know, when he died, So, you know, he died after the book came out, but before the miniseries came out. You know, he died in a in an accident in the, I think he was some a machine fell on him or something like that. Very tragic, very tragic. But still, it's, I like the way that they do this. Then we get to see Doc Rowe, and they say Doc Rowe died in Louisiana in 1998. He'd been a construction contractor, and again, that's all they told us about that. But you know, anyone who heard episode 80, you know, my interview with Doc Rowe's grandson, so we can get even more information as to what really happened, you know, to Doc Rowe all those years without his family even knowing what he did during the war. You know, he.
Yeah, I mean that's because we also had Chris on our show a long time ago. He did specifically we reviewed the episode that focuses on his
Right, episode
grandfather.
six.
Yeah, and you know, I think one of the most telling things that he brought up when he was on our show was, you know, they talked about the fact that like they knew that he was in the war, but that was about it. And then, you know, when the book came out or when the series came out, I don't remember which one, but at some point he got himself a copy of Band of Brothers to read it. And one of the first things he did was go back to the index, looked up his grandfather's name. It was like, oh, he's only mentioned on like three pages in this book. Like, how important could he be? I think that really kind of shows like how well that man kept two very distinct parts of his life separate. You know the old adage of like keep work at work and home at home,
Right.
like it definitely strikes me that, you know, Doc Rowe kept the war, like left it in Europe, and you know, when he came home, like he just wanted to live a regular life. So the fact that, you know, in this series we don't get much about him after the war. And then when you talk to his grandson, and it's like, yeah, we didn't know much about his wartime experience until way after the fact. Like, I think it really goes to show how well he separated those two facets of his
Yeah, but
life.
I mean, what Chris told me also was is, you know, that he wishes he would have known about that because, you know, it would have given him, you know, more information. Because Doc Rowe kept it all to himself, you know, his family didn't know about it and weren't able to, they don't, he didn't even doesn't even have stories, doesn't, there's so much information that is missing. And even for him, you know, he said to me that his biggest regret was not being able to talk to his grandfather about all this information. You know, when he was still alive.
Yeah, and I mean, but that's I think that's a common struggle for people who have family members who were a part of that generation, is a lot of them did not want to, you know, bring up that past or, you know, really want to go down that
Right.
route. And, you know, everybody deals with, you know, stress and trauma in different ways, so.
Correct. Makes sense. Now, I mean, because Doc Rowe isn't really mentioned in the book, you know, there's no epilogue about him in there either. After that, we get to see Frank Briganti, and he goes, Frank Briganti returned to Chicago and worked a postal route as a mailman. You know, again, trying to show the everyman aspect of the men. Again, he's also not, they don't give that much information about him either, you know, in the book. They talk about the fact that he showed up at various reunions, and that's about it. We don't get even the information about the fact that he was also a post off postman. Then we see a shot of Liebgott, and we hear Winter say, "Joe Liebgott returned to San Francisco and drove his cab." And again, that's all they tell us.
Yeah. But I know, like, you know, we're going through so many different people, so obviously they have to keep it kind of short. But I think that also, as far as like a storytelling or a narrative standpoint, like when you have little simple things like that where it's like you can see a guy like, 'cause Liebgott is a very integral part of the HBO series. So to have his story end out as like he went home and drove his cab, it's kind of like it kind of gives you that like Disney like, and we all live happily ever after kind of thing. So in some ways it is kind of nice because you're like, here's a guy, like we've seen all the terrible things that this guy has seen, and we've seen the emotion on his face and all of that. And something as simple as like he got to go home and do the thing he wanted to do, like it feels very cathartic in a way.
Exactly. Again, I mean, we did have that scene where he was talking about that he wants to, just go back home and make babies, and that's it. Drive his cab and get all the sailors to pay too much money.
Right.
Then the shot changes and we see Bull Randleman. It says Bull Randleman was one of the best soldiers I ever had. He went into the earth moving business in Arkansas. So the book has one sentence about Randleman's future, and it says Sergeant Denver Bull Randleman was a superintendent for a heavy construction contractor in Louisiana. That's all it says. So it's funny because in the book,
So
once again, in the book it says Louisiana, but in the movie they say Arkansas. So it makes you wonder which is correct.
I believe it was Arkansas. I'm thinking it's probably just a typo on Ambrose's part. 'Cause here's the thing is 'cause I mentioned it yesterday that, you know, I wanted to talk about Randleman, because so he lived long enough to see this series, 'cause obviously had he not, then the way they did this little ending would have been different. They would have been like, you know, he died and whatever.
Yes and no, because some of the guys they don't always mention which ones died before. There are a few significant ones, but okay.
To my recollection, he lived long enough to
Yes,
see
he
this
did. He died.
series
No, Bull Randleman died
because,
in 2003.
yeah, because the actor who played
Michael
him,
Crudwick.
he actually had the opportunity to speak to him and all that. But Bull Randleman actually had a very tragic ending, which I don't think a lot of people know about. And, you know, obviously this series was released in a specific point in time, and they operate with things as they were in that point in time. I feel like there almost should be like a documentary, like a, you know, 25 years after, like looking at the legacy and
There you go. Now
whatnot
you have an
of this
idea of
series.
what to start working on.
Yeah, pay me Netflix.
You got to pitch it to him first.
Yeah, so Bull Randleman, he had some health complications come up later in life, which is, you know, a typical thing that happens to all of us as we go through the aging process. And he had, I believe it was a dialysis catheter port put in, which I don't know how familiar you are with
Yeah, I'm a
dialysis,
little familiar with it, yeah.
but for, you know, the listeners who aren't as familiar, dialysis, it's a medical treatment that an individual can go through when they have kidney disease or kidney failure. And basically, 3, 4 times a week, you go to a place and they hook you up to this machine. And essentially, this machine takes your blood out of you, cleans it, returns it to you the way that your kidneys should be doing it. It's really, really not fun for people who have to do it. Super draining, very time intensive, not to mention, like, if you're at the point that you're using one of these machines, like, your quality of life is not the same, and like, you know, rarely is like this just the one thing that's going on with you at this point. So that being said, because it's a multiple time a week kind of treatment, what a lot of people get is it's called a catheter, and it's a surgically implanted device. So when you go to get hooked up to this machine, it's vastly easier to get hooked up and disconnected to it as opposed to trying to get blood. It's essentially like getting blood drawn, trying to find a good viable vein and all these things. And so Bull Rannleman, he underwent this procedure, which is a fairly common, normal procedure, but still can have complications and side effects. He went to go to a short-term assisted living kind of situation. And it was only supposed to be for like a month or two while he healed from the procedure of getting this catheter put in. And then once he was healed, he was going to go back home and, continue living his life as he needed to. Well, the assisted living place, the temporary assisted living place he was at, had a incident of gross negligence, malpractice, whatever, however you want to say it. But essentially, he didn't receive the care that he was supposed to at this facility, developed complications, and then when he finally received proper medical care to address these complications, it was too far gone. There was nothing really that could have been done, and he ended up dying much sooner than if he had been properly taken care of. Because the thing with dialysis is you can, depending on what stage of kidney disease or failure you're at, you can live an additional 5, 10 years, possibly. More advanced extreme cases, it's more like 1 to 2 years. But going from an outlook of potentially another 10 years of life to 1 month because of, medical malpractice, was really kind of a big disservice to this man. It'd be a disservice to anybody, but obviously the place he holds in a lot of people's hearts because of the story of Band of Brothers, like, it adds that layer to it. And it's one of those things that is unfortunate about Band of Brothers is that, now that we're 25 years removed from this series having come out, I believe all the members of Easy Company are gone
Yeah.
now.
The last one was Brad. Brad, I'm trying to remember his last name. Brad passed away, I think like 3 years ago.
So, like, obviously, because we're at that point in life and history where the few remaining World War II vets that we do have are hitting that 100 plus mark in their ages. It's not shocking that these guys are gone,
Brad
but I
Freeman,
think
Bradford Freeman. He was,
it's unfortunate that because we're at that point where we're like, yeah, most of our World War II vets are gone, that the injustices like the story of Sergeant Randleman kind of gets, forgotten
right.
as well.
That's true. Now, I mean, what I remember is I think he died of sepsis because of all that, He got an infection and passed away. Now, we were talking before about George Luz. So apparently, while he was in the middle of working, a commercial dryer fell on him, and that's when,
Oh God.
it apparently separated from its couplings and fell on him. It was instantaneous, from what I understand. So he thankfully didn't
That
suffer from that. We were talking about Bull, but the next line is even more gut-wrenching, because it says Winters is telling us that he went into the earth moving business in Arkansas, and he goes, he's still there. Just
Well,
a short 2 years later, unfortunately, he would die from sepsis. Then we get another shot, and we get to see Moore. He goes, Alton Moore returned to Wyoming with a unique souvenir: Hitler's personal photo albums. He was killed in a car accident in 1958. I wonder what
yeah, I'm
happened
sure
to the album at that point.
yeah, who knows? That'd be an interesting thing to to find out, see if he like left it in a will or something.
Yeah, well, again, it's 1958, so
Or
it's already been what is it, 60, almost 70 years since since that happened. Floyd Talbert, we all lost touch with in civilian life until he showed up at a reunion just before his death in 1981. Again, that it's a you know it, it just that line itself tells us how important it was for these men to get together, you know, in their reunions every year. So, you know, I think that's also great that they just have that one little line about it, and that's enough. So yeah, I like the way that they do that. And we know that Talbert got wounded because he got stabbed by Smith, you know, all those months ago. What it actually says in the book, there are two other members of the company, the last first sergeant and the original company commander, were all also victims of the war. Sergeant Floyd Talbert had wounds and scars, which he handled without difficulty, and memories which overwhelmed him. He became a drifter and a drinker. He made a living of sorts as a fisherman, hunter, trapper, and guide in Northern California. He had a series of heart attacks. Talbert was one of the few members of the company who just dropped out of sight. In 1980, Gordon enlisted the aid of his congressman and of George Luz's son, Steve, to locate Talbert. Sergeant Mike Ranney joined the search. Eventually, they located him in Redding, California, and persuaded him to attend the 1981 company reunion in San Diego. Ranney passed around his address. Winters and the others wrote to him. In his three-page handwritten reply to Winters, Talbert reminisced about
Right.
their experiences. "During the time you were leading us into Carrington, seeing you in the middle of that road wanting to move was too much. You recall when we were pulling back in Holland, Lieutenant Peacock threw his carbine onto the road. He would not move. Honest to God, I told him to retrieve the carbine and move, or I would shoot him. He did as I directed. I liked him. He was sincere and by-the-book officer, but not a soldier. As long as he let me handle the men, he and I got along all right. Dick, this can go on and on. I've never discussed these things with anyone on the earth. The things we had are darn near sacred to me," he signed off. "Your devoted soldier forever." Talbert had enclosed a recent photograph. He looked like a mountain man. In his reply, Winters told him to shave off the beard and get his haircut if he intended to come to San Diego. He did, but he still showed up wearing tattered hunting clothes. The first morning, Gordon and Don Moon took him to a men's store and bought him new clothes. Before the year was out, he died. Again, I like the way that they expand on this and tell us, you know, more than just the fact that he lost touch, you know, that it has a lot to do with his experiences, you know, and I think that's important for anyone watching this to understand, you know, that even the men who made it home without very many physical wounds definitely had, you know, mental wounds that they had to deal with over the years and decades. So at this point, Winters then says, "How we lived our lives after the war was as varied as each man." And then we get a shot of Lipton. He goes, "Carver Lipton became a glass-making executive in charge of factories all over the world. He has a nice life in North Carolina." You know, again, succinct. I'm aware of the fact that they can't go on and talk about so much about what everyone says. But in some ways, I sometimes feel that they miss something by just giving us one line about these guys. I think they need to expand it slightly more.
Yeah. And again, the he had a nice life in North Carolina. Again, it gives that, you know, and they lived happily ever after.
Exactly. I mean, the book on page 251 says Carwood Lipton majored in engineering at Marshall College, while his wife Joanne was bearing three sons. Lipton went to work for Owens Illinois Inc. He rose steadily in the firm. In 1971, he moved to London as director of manufacturing for eight glass factories in England and Scotland. In 1974, he went to Geneva, Switzerland, in charge of operations in Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. In 1975, Joanne died of a heart attack. Next year, Lipton married a widow, Marie Hope Mahoney, whose husband had been a close friend of Lipton's, just as Marie was a close friend of Joanne's. At the request of the CEO of United Glass, he wrote a pamphlet, Leading People. It was a subject he knew well. Lipton retired in 1983. He writes, "Currently living in comfortable retirement in Southern Pines, North Carolina, where I had decided when we were training in Camp McCall that I would someday live. My hobbies are much traveling throughout the world, golf, modern engineering, woodworking, and reading." So again, it's a little more that they could have added about his life, the way that it's mentioned. Then we get a shot of Welsh, and you know, we're told Harry Welsh. He married Kitty Grogan and became an administrator for the Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania school system. Again, that's all they're going to tell us. There's they're definitely going to keep us in suspense if there's anything else that really happens here. What they tell us here in the book on page 253 is Captain Harry Welsh got married immediately upon his return to the States with his bride, Kitty Grogan, wearing a dress made from the reserve chute he wore on D-Day and carried with him throughout the rest of the war. He went to college, taught, earned an MA, and became a high school counselor, then administrator. Again, that's all they're mentioning there about it. Then we get a shot of Spears, and he goes, Ronald Spears stayed in the army, served in Korea, and in 1958 returned to Germany as governor of Spandau Prison. He retired a lieutenant colonel. Now, first of all, I like the way that they tell us this about Spears, because with all of the, I guess, shady ideas of what was going on with Spears and stuff like that, the idea that they're still he that he stayed in the army for another, was it 15 years, is also great. But he had other problems because of the fact that with all of the stuff that he was sending back home. So the book talks about this on page 250. It says when Captain Spears got back to England in the summer of 1945, he discovered that the English widow he had married and who had borne his son wasn't a widow at all. Her husband reappeared from a POW camp. She chose him over Spears, and the couple kept all the loot Spears had shipped back from Europe. He decided to stay in the army. He made a combat jump in Korea and commanded a rifle company on the line in the war. In 1956, he attended a Russian language course in Monterey, California, and then was assigned to Potsdam, East Germany, as a liaison officer with the Soviet Army. In 1958, he became the American governor of Spandau Prison, Berlin, where Rudolf Hess was serving his life term. In 1962, he went to Laos with the U.S. mission to the Royal Lao Army. When E Company men called him today and opened the conversation by saying, "You don't remember me, but we were together during the war," Spears replies, "Which war?" His son, Robert, born in England during the war, is an infantry major in the King's Royal Rifle Corps, the Green Jackets. I like the fact that the book tells us that everything he looted, he didn't get. I guess what goes around comes around from that type of perspective, because we saw he was taking a lot of stuff. So
Yeah.
it's nice the way that they explain it to us. But basically, everyone gathers around Easy Company, school circle, and then Enders continues by saying, "For Easy Company, it was D-Day plus 434." Now, do you have any idea what D-Day plus 434 would be?
As in what the specific date was? Would that be August 23rd?
August 13th, very close.
Okay. Because I knew obviously the Japanese didn't surrender the day of the bombings, but for some reason I was thinking it was about a week after, but
So yeah, the men are joking around, and one of the guys goes, "A fast man would have had a Perko." And then Spears calls everyone, and goes, "Listen up." And then Winters goes, "We've got some news. This morning, President Truman received the unconditional surrender from the Japanese. The war is over." We're back to the narration, and Winters goes, "Regardless of points, medals, or wounds, each man in the 101st Airborne would be going home. Each of us would be forever connected by our shared experience, and each would have to rejoin the world as best he could." So again, the narration here is amazing. I really like the, I've mentioned this before, I like the fact that they chose Winters to be the voice of this final part of the series, and I think it's very effective, allowing us to get a deeper understanding, first of all, of what Winters thought of the men, but also to show that Winters, throughout their time, we're talking a period of what, 3 years. He is their leader, their father figure, throughout the whole thing. He's the guy looking out for them in so many ways that you sometimes can't even count them. So I really like the way that they do that and they present it. So I actually now want to spend a little bit of time talking about some of the other men that we know about that don't really get information, they don't give us information about because of the fact that that they were no longer in this last part, basically.
Right.
That thing. We'll start with Joe Toy. The describe This is on page 245 of the book. Sergeant Joe Toy describes his experiences. After being hit by 4th Purple Heart at Bastogne, I went through a series of operations, the main operations being the amputation of my right leg above the knee. Then later, I had 2 more operations. These were to remove shrapnel from my upper chest cavity. To remove them, the surgeon went in through my back. I was married on December 15, 1945, while still in the hospital in Atlantic City. I was discharged from the Army February 8, 1946. He was given an 80% disability. Before the war, he had been a molder in a foundry, but with a wooden leg, he couldn't do the work. He found employment in a textile mill in Reading, Pennsylvania, then worked 20 years for Bethlehem Steel as a bit grinder. He has 3 sons and a daughter. I used to take the boys hunting, fishing, but I never carried a gun. I was worried about tripping. This artificial leg, if something stops you, you're gone, you know. I never carried a gun, but I took them out deer hunting and fishing. Every year, I went camping in Canada with them. There have been big improvements in artificial legs since 1946. Troy feels the doctors of the VA hospitals have treated him well and kept him up to date with the latest equipment. He does have one complaint. He wants 2 legs, one slightly larger, where it joins the stump. But because the docs say 1 is enough, I don't dare gain or lose any weight, else the damn thing won't fit. So that's all they tell us about Joe Toy, who passed away in the early 90s, if I remember correctly, because or actually probably was right after the book came out. Joe Toy died on September 3rd, 1995. On 246, continues to talk about Garnier. The Sergeant Bill Garnier also lost his leg above the knee in Bastogne. After discharge in the summer of 45, he was given an 80% disability. He married, had a child, and went to work as a printer, salesman, VA clerk, and carpenter, all with an artificial leg. There were some mix-ups in his records, which cost him money and led to much dispute with the VA. In 1967, he finally got full disability and was able to retire. He threw away his artificial leg, and for the past 24 years, he has moved on crutches. He moves faster than most younger men with 2 good legs. He lives in South Philly, where he grew up with his wife, Fran. They have 5 children. The oldest son was an airborne trooper in Vietnam. He is very active in the 101st Association and in getting E Company men together. That's the way this segment ends. Is there anything else you would like to add?
No, I think it's a great way to close the series out. But yeah, it's definitely a vastly different scene and section of the entire series compared to the rest of it, because obviously they're actively telling the story as it's happening, and now, you know, the scenes that we've reviewed have been, you know, the closure kind of scenes.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Okay. So today's segment is a segment called Oh Brother, where my guest will give their top 5 movie brothers.
Okay.
So start with your number 5 and work your way up as always.
Number 5 is the film Step Brothers, featuring John C. Reilly and Will Ferrell. Mm-hmm. And then number 4 is going to be Boondock Saints, the featuring Norman Reedus and I forget the other actor, but pair of brothers who are mercenary hitmen in Boston. Then the film Warrior, which is kind of a lesser known one, but it has Tom Hardy in it, and it's about 2 brothers who are both fighting in a UFC style competition.
Right, and the other brother's Joel Edgerton.
Yeah. Number 2 is going to be The Outsiders, which is the film adaptation of the book by the same name. And then number 1 isn't necessarily a brothers-centric film, but the main characters are brothers. So Tombstone.
Oh, that definitely fits in there, of course.
Because obviously you have all the Earp brothers.
Yes, of course.
Along with Doc Holliday, and
you also have the brothers on the other side, the Clantons.
Yep.
So yeah, that makes sense. Wow. Okay, that is a great list. Thank you very much for that. And now we will play the daily game of name that World War II movie. And once again, let's hope it's one you've seen. So let's spin the wheel and see what you get. And again, it could be something that we talked about over the last few days also.
Yeah.
Yeah, that is possible. Mm. Okay, and this is a movie from 2007. Most of the movie actually takes place before the beginning of World War II, but there is a very long scene that takes place in Dunkirk. And you and I talked about this yesterday. So do you have any idea what movie this might be? I mean, I can give you the synopsis of the movie that doesn't really touch upon
Is
World War II.
it
Well,
Imitation Game again?
no. The
No.
Imitation was 2014.
Oh yeah, 2007.
And that doesn't have anything to do with Dunkirk. So the synopsis of the movie, again, this will not have anything to do with World War II, but you can still, maybe that'll help you. A 13-year-old girl irrevocably changes the course of several lives when she accuses her older sister's lover of a crime he did not commit.
Drawing a blank.
We talked about this yesterday. It stars James McAvoy.
Oh, Atonement.
Yes.
There we go. If there's one thing that having a movie podcast has taught me is that I don't know a ton about, or there's so many movies that I've never seen, and even the movies I have seen, like at this point, like they all kind of mesh together a little bit.
Okay, I understand that. I'm very familiar with that type of problem, so it makes sense. All right, not a problem. All right, so John, would you like once again tell people where they can find you?
Yeah, if you guys are interested in another podcast that takes a look at pop culture and film, check out the Armchair Commanders podcast. We review war movies. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Audible, pretty much anywhere that podcasts stream. If you want to find us on social media, you can find us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, TikTok under Armchair Commanders as well.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, you can find me on Instagram, you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So I will be back tomorrow. But until then, curry!
Great.